You're listening to The Big Conversation. This is UK Low Carb. The Big Conversation. The show where my guest and I debate the latest nutrition news affecting the low-carb and keto community. This show is sponsored by my business, Deliciously Guilt-Free, where you can have your cake and eat it. We make keto cake that meets your macros. Head to deliciouslyguiltfree.com where you can get yours. If you'd like to be part of the big conversation, then please join our Facebook group, UK Low Carb. You are all more than welcome. Without much further ado, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to The Big Conversation live on UK Low Carb Podcast. We are live on YouTube, Facebook and low carb groups here and all around the world. You can take part by sharing your thoughts using the hashtag UK Low Carb on Twitter and Instagram. Now, this is the podcast where we share individual stories and we have shows like this as well to help build the low carb and keto community, not just here in the UK, but also around the world. I'm your host, Dan Grief, and I believe that change comes from grassroots movement and that we are the change you want to see in the world. Today, I'm joined by our four amazing guests on The Big Conversation. Our first guest today is Dr. Jen Unwin. Dr. Jen is a retired consultant. She's a clinical health psychologist who helps people with food addictions into recovery. She's also the author of the book Fork in the Road. All of the book's proceeds go to the Public Health Collaboration. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jen Unwin.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you back on the show, Jen. We're also joined today by Professor Tim Noakes.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Welcome to the show, Prof. Tim. You have been very much missed on the show for the last couple of weeks, but it's great to have you here. Now, sure you know Prof. Tim already, but let me just tell you that Prof. Noakes is an athlete who's published more than 750 scientific books and articles. His publications include bestsellers and The Real Meal Revolution. He's also the founder of the Noakes Foundation, the focus of which is to raise funds to help support quality research into nutrition. Welcome to the show, Prof. Noakes.
Thank you, Dan. Lovely to be with you again.
Great stuff. And our next guest is Pauline Cox.
Hello.
Now, Pauline is a nutritionist with a key interest in metabolic health. She has particularly use of healthy ketogenic approach to improving healthy and longer lives. Welcome to the show, Pauline.
Hi. Great to be here, Dan.
Great to have you on as well, Pauline. And you, of course, were on the show last week, so it's good to have you back on. We also are joined by Dr. David Unwin. Now, Dr. Unwin is an award-winning GP, and not only does he save the NHS almost £60,000 a year, but has improved the lives of hundreds of people, maybe even thousands of people, by empowering them out of their medication dependency through changing their way of eating to the low-carb way of life. Welcome to the show, Dr. David Unwin.
Hello, I'm super excited to see what we're going to get up to over the next couple of hours.
Fantastic stuff. And before I start, I just want to make this point very clear. We're not giving medical advice and none of these guests are your doctor. This is just an interesting piece of information from each of them that we think that you would like to know. Welcome to the show, everyone. Let's start our big conversation. Welcome, everyone, to the show. Now, we're just going to start by going through each of my guests. The guests will share an article that they've actually told us about previously, and we will start in a moment with Jen Unwin. Each of the guests will then share this information with you and then give us a bit of a précis as to what the information says, and then we're going to debate it between us. If, however, you want to be part of the big conversation, you'll notice we have the hashtag UK Low Carb, so you can actually put your tweets, you can actually comment on the Facebook pages as well, and we will try and share some of these throughout this episode, so you can be part of this as well. But I'm now going to hand over to Jen Unwin. Jen, you're going to do your presentation on food addiction and mental health in adolescence, a systematic review. So over to you, Dr. Jen Unwin.
Thanks so much. Yes, this is a paper that's just come out really recently, only in the last couple of weeks or so. And I thought this would be an interesting one to discuss because it raises a number of issues that I'm interested in and I think are really important clinically, if you like, and just some really interesting themes coming out of it. So it's an Australian team. They've done a review of food addiction in adolescence, and particularly with an interest as well as the links with mental health. They did quite a sort of systematic search, but ended up with 27 studies and did what's called a narrative review, because they couldn't really sort of amalgamate the data. They had to sort of just look at it and give us some sort of themes and results that came out of it. So most of the studies that they looked at used an instrument called the Yale Food Addiction Scale, which is, to be honest, really practically the one and only validated measure of food addiction symptoms. So they were able to find 25 studies using that measure. Some of them use the version for children, which is a slightly adapted version that uses language that's suitable for children. And the YFAS, as it's more simply called, is based on the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual criteria for substance use disorders. So many people will know that food addiction isn't actually recognized as a sort of distinct disorder yet in either the DSM or the ICD, which is the International Classification of Diseases, which the WHO put out. So they took the criteria that you might use for, let's say, alcohol misuse or drug misuse, and apply that to food. So it's a very commonly used measure in the field. There are a number of kind of really interesting findings. The main one really is that food addiction had rates up to about 50% in adolescents who were seeking clinical help for eating disorder problems. And it also seems to co-occur with mental health problems like anxiety and depression and eating disorders, but also is higher in adolescents with obesity and poor quality of life and poor self-esteem. One interesting finding was that the symptoms seem to be slightly less severe than they are in adults. So those are the kind of headlines. And then the important points for me were, I've got a number of important points that I wanted to sort of throw up for discussion, if you like. The first is that the findings from the paper seem to really support what we see clinically, you know, when you're working with people with food addiction. There seems to be a very early onset and then a worsening, and it doesn't kind of get better over time, it gets worse over time. When you talk to people about their histories with food, they tend to start really young. They often worsen in adolescence because that's the time when they have the independence and the money to go and buy their own foods, or, you know, be getting their own food. So that certainly ties in with the stories that I hear, that symptoms develop and worsen over time. So that ties in with this idea that the symptoms seem to be slightly worse in this, better in this group than they are when you look at the adult research. But I think that's just because people are getting worse over time. There's this strong link with mental health problems in adolescence, and also obviously later on so clinically, you often see people start with a food addiction. It's almost like a gateway drug, as we would say, that people, kids have access to sugar. You know, I believe that's a psychoactive substance, and that worsens with time. But also then, you know, there's evidence from other literature that then links into problems with other addictions, like alcohol, for example, but also other drugs. There's definitely evidence for that. It also supports what we see clinically in that there's more females tend to have food addiction problems, or at least come forwards with them, and that's supported in the paper. And is also in clinical practice, you see a lot of people struggling with weight problems and food addiction. So again, that's sort of backed up by this paper. they mention in the study that, of course, there are no clinical services for either adolescents or adults actually with food addiction problems. And that's partly because it's not recognized as a distinct disorder, because that's how services tend to get funded, is that we recognize that people have a problem with alcohol addiction, then services and research will be funded. So part of the important issue here is that food addiction hasn't yet been recognized officially as a diagnosis. So there aren't services to address it. So a lot of young people are either going to end up in mental health services who won't recognize this as a problem. And certainly when I worked in mental health services, there wasn't an interest in nutrition at all. So that definitely needs to change. Or they'll end up in an eating disorder service. And currently, as far as I know, most of the eating disorder services are based on the idea of eating everything in moderation and some cognitive behavior therapy. That's the sort of model that they have. So anyone whose actual problem is food addiction will not get appropriate diagnosis and treatment. So for me, that's a big issue. An overlapping issue is this close association in adolescents between eating disorders and food addiction. And that's also been found in the adult studies that have been done. So in this paper, where there were 7 out of 8 studies which found a really strong correlation between binge eating disorder and food addiction, and I've seen rates reported in adult studies of over 90% overlap. So people with binge eating disorder also being diagnosable with food addiction. And 9 out of 10 studies in this paper found a strong correlation between depression and anxiety and food addiction problems. So it's a massive problem. Another interesting thing that came out was they mentioned about impulsivity, and that what you find in the adolescents being seeming to have food addiction problems tended to have higher scores on impulsivity measures. But I've seen that in adult studies as well. But I question the direction of that relationship, because we know that the way that sugar acts on the brain is to sort of dampen down the activity in the frontal region of the brain, which is where we have sort of impulse control. And I'm not sure whether it's that impulsive people become food addicts, or that sugar and refined carbohydrates dampen down our ability to have control and become more impulsive. And that's the sort of study that needs to be done and would need to be done, obviously, as a sort of following up people who were in treatment for food addiction, for example. So the size of the problem is enormous. And if you take a sort of a reasonable population estimate of about 8%, which is the same, it turned out about the same in adolescents as it would in adults, that's 4.3 million adults in the UK that would have a food addiction problem. It's a huge problem. And I was really pleased to see that they were saying that there's been a lot of the papers that they reviewed, the 27, were very recent. So there's obviously more and more interest. And I've seen that. I did a bit of a literature review of the adult literature, and the numbers of papers being published every year is going up more or less exponentially in this field. So I'm hopeful that the tide is turning and that this will be recognized as a condition. And that will make a massive difference, as I say, to, you know, services being available to people and more research being funded. And the last point I wanted to make before we sort of go on to a broader discussion about the paper was that I was that teenager. I was that teenager overeating sugar and not being able to stop, which was the main symptom that these adolescents described. Was that they wanted to quit but weren't able to. And that was me. And it took me over 30 years to find low carb and find the answer. So that's why I'm so passionate about this topic. And I really think, you know, we need to help people early and help families early to, you know, so because prevention is way, way better than cure. So that's me. And I'm interested to hear what people made of it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that, Jen. A really powerful article. I just want to let everybody know, if you want to read these articles that my guests are sharing today, there is a link that I think Josh, my assistant, can put out to everyone. And on that link, you'll see the connection to all of those four articles. So you can read these for yourselves. Brilliantly presented there, Jen. Really, really accessible. And now really is the time when we come to the rest of the panel. Would anyone like to make any comments or anything they want to say? David, over to you.
Yeah. A comment and then a question. I'd just like to share with the viewers, really, the how difficult it is for clinicians. So that I can get help for somebody with gambling addiction, and there isn't even a substance. So I can refer you and help you with that. I can help you with nicotine addiction. I can help you with alcohol addiction.
Yeah.
But actually, I know in clinical practice that particularly for people who are very heavy, a large number of those people have actually got some kind of food addiction if you look for it. And it's interesting, I didn't look for it for years and years. But if you ask people, they'll tell you that I know my problem is bread or all sorts of things I've been told. And I remember one lady who I'd looked after for 30 years, weighed somewhere over 25 stone. And she burst into tears because it was the first time she had ever confessed to anybody that her problem was bread, that she couldn't just manage moderation. The odd slice of bread, she said, it's half a loaf at a time. And I feel the cruelty of it, I think, is it makes people feel like idiots when they're not, because they're so ashamed, because it's not even an illness. So they feel, oh, I lack willpower. And yet, just like somebody with an alcohol problem or a gambling problem, what they need is support and to understand. So really, it's just, as a clinician, it's so frustrating. If it's not recognized as an illness, there are no clinics. And there are huge numbers of people around the world who have no help, no help at all. And yes, it's true, there are. I have been shouted down in meetings by other doctors who say, you know, but food addiction doesn't exist, David. And so I'm sad. It is for clinicians. But then just my, go on, Jen.
No, I was just going to say, I think the tide is turning, and I hope it's recognized. I think it will be recognized in our lifetimes. I think it's just so difficult because so many vested interests to get against the recognition of it. And just so that people know, the public health collaboration in the UK is very close to David and I's hearts. And we've got a new subcommittee there looking at food addiction, and we're going to be campaigning and advocating for recognition of this condition and for research. And myself and a few colleagues are starting a clinical study where we're just doing a practical thing, a bit like David and I've done really, where we're providing group treatment for people who self-identify with food addiction. And we're seeing how we can get on with treating them in groups and what kind of outcomes we get. So do get in touch via the PHC if you're interested, and please support the work of the PHC if you're interested and feel passionate about this topic.
Wonderful. Just before I come to you, Pauline, and I will certainly, I just want to say it's interesting what you just said there about the fact that gambling is identified as an addiction without a substance. So in a way, you think it'd be an easier thing to say that food can be an addiction. But I was just going to say on that point, though, Jen, when you're talking about food addictions generally and how many people, what about the breakdown of types of food? Because that's the thing that I think, just like you said, people are addicted to bread. I don't know anyone who's addicted to sausages, or, well, maybe they are, but I've never heard of it, or steak or bacon. Yeah. So, you know, what about the types of food and what's research into
Nicole
that?
Nicole Avena published a really good paper, I'm sure it was her, on the sort of things that people report. So people who score as food addicted, what sort of things do they struggle most with? Yeah, you're exactly right. It's all the kinds of usual suspects that we know about: pizza, donuts, bread, crisps, chocolate. So sugary, fatty, salty. The only one that came up reasonably high on the list, number 10, was cheese that was would maybe surprise some people. But actually, when you work with people with food addiction, cheese is often a trigger, actually, and something that they can't moderate. It's often something that people do have to kind of quit or be extremely careful with in the end, if they have this tendency. So they tend to be the Nova 4 foods that we've all been hearing about recently, the ultra processed foods, the highly sugary refined carbohydrate foods that people struggle with. Yeah, like you say, not broccoli on the whole or eggs.
Yeah. Pauline, did you want to come in with some comments on that?
Food. Can you hear me?
I can now.
I think it's really important that people understand the influence that the foods that they choose have on their hormones and their biochemistry, because it's not something we're educated about. Mm-hmm. And it almost becomes too late by the time we've really garnered an appetite for these highly processed foods. The damage has already been done. And that feedback system, that drive to keep eating, when we consume these highly processed foods, I mean, it literally has a damaging effect on the satiety hormones produced within our gut that then have a direct communication with our brain. And we just have this drive to continue eating. And, you know, our drive to eat is there as a human survival tool. You know, it's there to help us evolve and survive. But when those communications start to become disrupted, and as David pointed out, you know, people think that it's them and they're greedy, they have no willpower, they have no self-control. It's absolutely not. It's fundamentally down to fighting your biochemistry and things becoming completely disrupted from a ghrelin perspective, from a CCK, which is our satiety hormone. And our bodies are in this state of foraging for essential fats and essential amino acids. And when these particular neurons within the gut become damaged and retracted into the mucosal membrane, we are not producing that satiety hormone. And so we are just driven to keep eating until we are supposed to get this trigger to say, I have the fats I need, I have the amino acids I need. And it's disrupting this very beautiful, intricate system that's going on in the body that we then see as our own fault and an issue we have with willpower.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. And I think providing that information to people and that explanation is actually liberating. So, you know, people often say, oh, isn't it stigmatizing to say, you know, it's an addiction. That's one of the arguments that's been made against it. I saw someone was asking what are the arguments that are made against acknowledging that you can have a food and a sugar addiction. They did some work. It was a really lovely study looking at if you showed somebody a picture of an obese person and you gave them an explanation, which was sort of, you know, they need to eat less and move more. Or if you gave them a picture of an obese person and you gave them an explanation of, you know, certain foods can be addictive, they act in this way in the brain. People were much more sympathetic to the person with the addiction explanation, which makes complete sense to me. And you feel more sympathetic to yourself and kind of angry about the you know, what's got you to this point, because as you say, our brains and our guts have been hijacked, really. Dopamine's a really major part of it, and once you explain the brain rewiring to people, they understand it, and it helps them to sort of have that knowledge and motivation to be abstinent from those foods, because once they've understood the damage that they do, they can, it's not easy, but they can more easily make some choices and put some things in place in their environment to support, you know, staying abstinent, basically. Because, you know, abstinence is the treatment for addiction. We all know that works. Yes. And if you just take the model of alcohol, you know, you wouldn't ask an alcoholic to moderate. You wouldn't even think of it. So if we just take that same model, and it really works for people, you know, they really understand that, and it really makes a difference. And as David says, the support part is really important. And again, we know that in addiction, we know that, you know, AA and, you know, all of these kind of support groups are really essential to keep people in long-term recovery. But I totally agree with you, Pauline. The earlier, the better. The more, the less rewiring that's gone on. I mean, a lot of the viewers will watch the Chris Val Tullican program where he ate junk food for a month, and they literally showed on the scans the rewiring of his brain, which hadn't reversed even 6 weeks later when he'd stop eating it. You know, you do some kind of pretty serious rewiring, and that's why symptoms get worse over time. It's why it's hard to be abstinent. But once you're abstinent, you know, it's really important to stick to that, because the minute you relapse, you're back way worse, exactly like an alcoholic, because the brain's lighting up, the dopamine system goes wild. And they've shown that in animal studies as well, that it's much worse to have abstinence and then access, where you do that with in the animal studies, they go crazy when they have intermittent access. So this is the problem, in a way, is how you get into the sort of binge eating problems, is that people try and deny themselves, then they crack, and then they binge, because that's the natural biological process. Like you were saying, Pauline, that's the process that it's the fundamental sort of survival process, to binge. And then all the guilt and the problems that come after that, and then they will try restriction again. So I think, again, explaining that to people so that they understand, you know, abstinence has to be abstinence. If you've once got a problem, if you can't moderate it, you have to abstain.
Totally agree. I just want to say, Tim, did you want to come in there in the conversation?
Yeah, fantastic discussion. Thank you so much, both of you. Really amazing. So my opinion is that obesity equals food addiction. And I think if we would address it like that, we can start making progress. You know, all the people that I've helped, they tell you how they've got rid of controlling the addiction. I spoke to a guy in America who'd lost 400 pounds. I'm not sure how many stones that is. 400 pounds. And I asked him, said, tell me, what was it like when you weighed 600 plus pounds? And he said, I could eat a massive meal, and within 30 minutes, I was starving again, and I would have to eat more. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting that he then went low carbs, lots of fat, and he solved the issues, and he lost all the weight. But until we recognize that food addiction is the key driver of obesity, every day we read, oh, we don't know what causes obesity. You know, it's either no, you know, CISO or calories in, calories out, or we don't know. It's too complex. And that's nonsense. And key to it all is sugar. And I'm beginning to realize, and I'll address this again, that sugar is the real driver of the problem. And in a sense, the low-carb movement, we've made one error in sugar as being the key driver of so much damage. Of course, yeah. It's processed foods, etc. But what changed in our nutrition was sugar. It wasn't the wheat and it wasn't the rice. They're not helpful, but it was the sugar that was the real start of the problem. And I'll come back to that later.
Excellent point. Yeah, thank you for that.
I'll just make one point, which is that you can get normal weight food addicts. So yes, I think and we've definitely seen it, haven't we, David? In the people who have really big struggles with weight, you know, we've had people who've lost 9 stone, 8 stone, 10, you know, that they do. So quite right, where people have big struggles with obesity, then there's often a food addiction issue. But you can get normal weight food addicts as well. I know one or two. Go on, David.
Yeah, just quick point, David, because you have to have to move on. And
very
moment,
quick.
That's okay.
The other point, there are underweight food addicts, because I'm beginning to see a clinical thing, which is very thin children, and they are so picky. They will only eat sugary this and sugary that, and the mums, their mothers are begging and pleading, and they're not getting enough protein. So that you know, thinking about it, it covers a very wide gamut. But the most worrying ones are these almost malnourished children I'm seeing, very thin, hardly having any protein or any vegetables, because they will only have sugary foods. And the parents are beside themselves, not knowing how to handle that.
Yeah. Yeah, very good point. And that is a shocking truth of our, the problems are going to be in the next 10, 20 years when those children grow into being adults. You suddenly think, what's going to be the outcome for them then? Thank you so much for that, Dr. Jen. That is a superb article. Great start to the show. But unfortunately, we have to move on. But that's also positive because now we're going to go over to Professor Tim Noakes. And your paper today is the association of lipid, inflammatory and metabolic biomarkers with age at onset for incident coronary heart disease in women. So without much further ado, over to you, Tim Noakes.
Thanks, Dan. You know, because I'm such a humble person, I didn't give you the really important paper that we really should be discussing. And this is this one, which lovely long title. And it's titled Hiding Unhealthy Heart Outcomes in a Low-Fat Diet Trial. The Women's Health Initiative Randomized Controlled Dietary Modification Trial finds that postmenopausal women with established coronary heart disease were at increased risk of an adverse outcome if they consumed a low-fat, heart-healthy diet. And the only reason we're not discussing it is because I'm the author, and I'm really proud that this work, which I've been working on for a couple of years, probably 10 years, I finally managed to get it published. And it was through when I was writing this that I came across the article of today. So let me just give you a little bit of background. Why am I so interested in the Women's Health Initiative? Now, we've got to differentiate the Women's Health Initiative from the Women's Heart Study. They're two separate studies. When I was excommunicated by my university, they invited the person who was the head of the Women's Health Initiative to come and debate me. And he said, Noakes is wrong because Noakes says it's diabetes that is causing heart disease, and we all know it's cholesterol. And on that grounds, everything happened to me. But in the debate I had with this professor, I showed how they'd hidden evidence for harm in the Women's Health Initiative study. They had hidden evidence that women who were with had previous heart disease and went on the low-fat, heart-healthy diet were at 26%, that's correct, increased risk of heart disease during the study that would lasted 8 years. And they managed to hide it. They hid the data. And I exposed that during the debate, but it was like it didn't matter because, you know, I was obviously so wrong. about 4 months ago, I decided, I wonder where the Women's Health Initiative is today. And I went and looked at the literature and I found two new papers. And what they've shown is that now that 26% increased risk of heart attack has increased to 60%. 60% increased risk of a subsequent heart attack if you had coronary heart disease in these women and you ate the low-fat diet. And they hid it again. And they used explanations to try to hide it. They were so successful that the final paper from the Women's Health Initiative doesn't even discuss the people who had started the trial with heart disease. It ignores them. And so it only takes the healthy people and shows that they do okay on the diet. They don't do marvelously. So what my paper, which is coming out in Open Heart in hopefully in a few weeks' time, shows the distortion of that, how they hid the data, and how it's unbelievable that the paper was published, that without properly people getting to grips with it. So anyway, I was almost finished with that article when I came across the study that we're looking at today. And I initially made the error. I thought it was from the Women's Health Initiative. And I thought, amazing, the Women's Health Initiative has been able to disprove the Women's Health Initiative. Because, but unfortunately, it wasn't. It was the Women's Health Study. And the Women's Health Initiative is an NIH-funded study, and it used multiple centers. But the study we're talking about today, the Women's Heart Study, comes from Harvard. And the lead author, not of this article, but the lead author of the Women's Heart Study was a great friend of mine, and she was trained by one of my great epidemiologist, Dr. Ralph Paffenbarger, who I was very closely associated with, and we ran a marathon together, and so we were great friends. But it began, the Women's Heart Study begins as a study to see if increasing aspirin or increasing vitamin E will prevent heart disease in these women. They weren't postmenopausal. They were perfectly healthy women. And many of them were physicians in the greater area of Boston and so on. And they followed them now, and they found that vitamin E made no difference and aspirin made no difference. But they had fortunately measured all the so-called risk factors for heart disease in 1993, an amazing 50 array of 50 different markers. And they then followed these women through till 2020, so from 1993 to 2020. So it was a fantastic follow-up. And what did they find? They found that there's the two factors that predict heart attack risk in these women is diabetes and insulin resistance, and that's it. It's astonishing. Even smoking is not anywhere near as strong a risk factor as diabetes. So for me, this literally is one of the most important papers in the field. But did anyone hear about it? Did you hear about it? Was it reported in The Guardian? No. Or The Telegraph? No. Because it conflicts so with the theory that it's the low-fat diet is helping us. So to, in very brief summary, if we look at the hazard ratios, and they tell us how probable there might be a relationship between this variable that he measured and the outcome. So a hazard ratio, Walter Willett at Harvard, if he sees a hazard ratio 1.1, he says that's significant, which of course is nonsense. We normally take a hazard ratio above 2, which kind of starts to suggest that the two variables might be related. In this study, the relationship between heart attack or coronary heart disease and diabetes was hazard ratio of 10. That is, it's out of the ballpark. It is just unbelievable. And metabolic syndrome had a hazard ratio of 6. Hypertension was 4.6. Obesity was 4.3. And smoking was only 3.9. So insulin resistance and diabetes have a greater risk for causing heart disease than smoking. And the marker in the blood that predicts heart attack risk was not LDL cholesterol. That had a hazard ratio of 1.4, which is meaningless, 1.4. But they came up with a thing that they measured called the lipoprotein insulin resistance score. And how could they have come up with this score in 1993? I don't know. But what they did was they took their blood and they put it under a magnetic resonance machine. And they measured the size of the particles of many of the lipoproteins. It wasn't just the LDL particles. It was VLDL and HDL. And they then come up with this lipoprotein score, which they show is the best predictor of insulin resistance. And the hazard ratio for the lipoprotein insulin resistance score was 6 point something, which is also astronomical. So this is an incredibly important paper because let's just again remind you that this is one of the key points of the paper. Of more than 50 factors examined, diabetes and lipoprotein insulin resistance had the highest relative risk, particularly for premature coronary heart disease. And then their meaning, this is what they interpret, what the study means. Risk profile appears to differ by age at coronary heart disease onset in women, with the greatest risk for premature events associated with diabetes and insulin resistance. And there you are. And I'm just going to finish up because I want to bring in the sugar story. So there's a fabulous book that's just been published called Ravenous: Otto Warburg, the Nazis, and the Search for the Cancer Diet Connection. This is an astonishing book. You must read it because the author, who again is one of these brilliant investigative journalists like Nina Teicholt and Gary Taubes, he comes to the conclusion that sugar, and fructose particularly, is the key driver for cancer. And it's an amazing story how he takes Otto Warburg, the Second World War, the persecution of the Jews, how he takes that and puts it together in a package. And it's an amazing book. You just read it, just you can't put it down. And he comes to the conclusion that diet is driving cancer. And not only that, it's carbohydrates. That's the one book. You need then go to back to read Gary Taubes and The Case Against Sugar. And finally, the book that I've had in my bookshelf for a long time, The Saccharine Disease by T.L. Cleave, one of the classic books, 1974. And I was reading last night his chapter on coronary heart disease, chapter 8, coronary heart disease. He says, it's all sugar, it's all diabetes causing coronary heart disease. And he draws this from observational epidemiology of how people's health differed. The people eating traditional foods, when the sugar arrives, that's the problem. The refined carbohydrates are a problem, but they were introduced long before the health deteriorated. It's when you add the sugar, that's the killer. So that's my message. We've underestimated the importance of sugar, and I'm trying to make the point that this article tells us that it's diabetes we should be worried about for heart disease. And I would argue that the diabetes is being driven by in a major case by sugar.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Thank you so much for that, Tim. What an insight. I knew it was going to be an amazing panel, but I'm even blown away so far by what we've had from the two speakers so far. Just to let people know, and actually I need to let you know something as well, Tim. So Sam Apple is the author of Ravenous, and he heard our podcast together a few weeks ago, and he was so touched that you're reading his book that he's now said he'd like to come on the podcast and talk about these issues. So he's going to come on and talk about that book in particular. I'm going to get a copy for my bookshelf behind me, and I will read that for sure, including there are some great people up here already. Pauline, you're up there. Tim Noakes, you're up there. Nina Tyschultz is coming on the show tomorrow. She's up there. Jen will be up there very soon. I'm waiting for David's book to go up there. So maybe one day soon, who knows? Or maybe my own little pamphlet alongside it all one day, who knows? But thank you. I just want to say then, anyone want to ask any questions? And then after we have this bit of debate, we're just going to go to some of what the listeners and the viewers are saying today. And I'll tell them where they can get these articles to read for themselves. But over to you, David Unwin.
Yeah. Well, just to support what Tim has said, so I also was looking into the evidence for why we believe what we believe. And in my teaching, the Framingham study was one of the most famous studies for the idea that cholesterol was furring up your arteries. But I looked again at the Framingham study, and this is what I found, that they actually, the same team, published something on liver function. And they said here, the people with the top 25% or the worst liver function, the top or the worst quarter of liver function experienced a 67% increase in cardiovascular disease. And that means, you see, that liver function is far more important, far better predictor of what's going to happen to our patients than cholesterol itself. And they've known it, again, for a very long time. And we're all asking the question of, well, isn't it interesting, the silence on that? So much has been known for so long, and we seem to take a very long time to learn. But there it is, support from the Framingham study. Again, what Tim is saying, that it's about insulin resistance and it's about type 2 diabetes. And insulin resistance, you see, leads to fatty liver disease, which is now twice as many people as have diabetes. It's a quarter of the developed world. And so abnormal liver function is a call to arms. We need to do something. It's another pandemic, and we've known for so long.
Yeah, great. Jen?
Yeah, just to say that what I really love about the paper is that people often ask, you know, when we're doing the low-carb groups and so on, and you're talking about low-carb, and people's main concern is around, it's always about cholesterol and heart attacks, isn't it? And that's what the families say to them. So what I love about this is it's just fantastic evidence that you can just share with people to say, well, you know, no, actually, you know, is the insulin resistance and the diabetes, which, you know, this approach is going to help you with, that's going to make the big difference to you. So that's my big takeaway from it, is that from a practical point of view, the sort of reassurance that will give a lot of people.
Yeah, totally agree. What's interesting though, it's just like, you know, so many of you have been in the field, so you're actually not dealing with this as an academic study, you're seeing this firsthand. So why is there so much resistance? When you actually say, you know, like, for instance, it seems like the canary giving us the warning signs of the liver, and yet there's a lot of resistance here. Tim?
Well, it's the control of the sugar industry. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1965, they funded Harvard to come out and say that sugar was safe and that high-fat diets caused heart disease and that you could ignore triglycerides. They said, ignore triglycerides because it's all in the cholesterol. And they were paid a little bit of money, $50,000 today in today's money, and the two senior professors did it, and that was it. And then there's a formation of the International Life Sciences Institute, who is a front for Coca-Cola and for the sugar industry. And they were strongly involved in my trial. Absolutely. All the key players who were against me have links to ILSI. So those are the issue. It's just that the sugar industry is so incredibly powerful. It drives or it controls what you're allowed to teach at medical schools, and it drives what dietitians are allowed to be taught. So it's sugar is all over the story. Yeah.
Jen?
And that's the same. It just links back into the food addiction story, that the major paper which argues against food addiction was funded by the RIP Institute. And Dr. RIP is funded by the Corn Refiners of America to the tune of some thousands of dollars every month. And in fact, if you just Google RIP in the New York Times, you'll see the whole story exposed. So I saw someone asking on the chat before about why this isn't recognized. It's just because there's lots of vested interests for food addiction, sugar addiction, not to be recognized as a problem. Sorry, Pauline, go ahead, because I know you had your hand up as well.
That's okay. I think there's also, we need to recognize the fact that pharmaceutical companies make billions of dollars out of statins, for one, and how interesting it is how they can do their statistical wizardry to promote statins as being this wonder drug that can save us all from cardiovascular disease and coronary heart disease. And actually, research will show us that there's a 46% increase in insulin resistance when you're taking statins, which, how ironic. the very thing that will drive coronary heart disease is the thing that's been driven by the medication that we've been told to take to keep our hearts healthy. And $100 billion by one pharmaceutical company alone in statins. I think it's so important that the public understand that money is to be made out of sick care, and we have to take our own health into our hands.
I totally agree. The only thing is, as well, I think that eventually this is going to break because national healthcare systems can't afford it and insurance companies can't afford it, or they're going to change their terms so that you don't really have any cover at all. And I think there's a natural breaking point, but I hope that we just save people before then, so they're aware, like you say, to take this into their own hands, because our healthcare systems can only patch up injury or ill health when it happens. They can't stop an unhealthy lifestyle from doing the damage in the first place. And I think you're completely right there, Pauline, in what you say. Thank you so much for that, Tim. That is an absolutely superb article there. Absolutely nothing wrong with sharing your own article as well. That's fine by me. So please do again. And if anyone else has done that on the show, that's absolutely fine, David. So I just want to say thank you so much for that. And before we go into our next speaker, just aware of the time, which is Pauline. Before we go across to you, Pauline, I just want to share some of the things that have been said. But before I do that, we have a link appearing on the screen now. That's my website, deliciouslyguiltfree.com. But if you go to that, you've got the links there. So you can either be watching this on YouTube, Facebook, and you've got the links for that. But also there's a link on that page where you can get all of these lovely articles to read for yourself. So if you go and have a look there, then that's the link for that there. Right. I'm just going to select then some of the lovely comments we've got. And can I just say, unlike any other sort of show, I think, on planet Earth, I know these people, they're my friends, and so it's lovely to see their names. So I want to say hello, Nicola Locke, who I know many of you know as well. Hi, also delighted to be here. Great to have you listening today, Nicola. Great to have you on board. We've got Roxy, who said how exciting, which is great. Thank you so much. That was left via Facebook. Jana in South Africa, who I feel like I'm becoming friends with now, because I know her very well through Tim's team. Hi, everyone. Looking forward to this interesting discussion. Now, Joe says this, which I think is definitely true. What an awesome lineup. Thank you for that, Joe. And then I'm just going to get something here from Ken Armstrong, who's a great guy as well. And he has written this. I think this is on YouTube. Alas, there's still many practitioners who still don't believe food addiction is a thing, which I completely agree with. And Susie Edge, of course, is also an absolute legend. While there are many people who dismiss the idea of food addiction. How can I miss Yvonne Lane? Yvonne's here. I'd be up for helping with the PHC thing on food addiction. So there you go. And just actually, you don't just say, Jen, what's the PHC for those who might not have heard of it?
Yeah, Public Health Collaboration, www.phcuk.org. Jump over and have a look. Yeah, so it's a UK charity trying to spread good nutrition advice. And as I say, we're going to get a sister website called Food Addiction Resources coming very soon. Going to be lots of resources for the public, but also practitioners. And we'll be campaigning on some of these issues as well.
Fantastic. And Ken has said this, which I love, as you were talking there before, he's nodding madly in agreement, which is, I think, what we're all doing. So that's great. There's nobody actually on the other side of the argument. So I'll get a big pharmacy or big food corporate type in next time, maybe, and we'll see what happens. Naming no names. Next time on UK Low Carb.
When I started in practice, we had 57 people with type 2 diabetes in 1986. By 2012, the same practice with the same number of people, we'd suffered an eightfold increase in the number of people with type 2 diabetes. We had a pandemic.
Hello, you still there? Dan here. I can see you're one of the keen ones because you're still listening. So, got a very simple request. Please go and rate and review this podcast now on Apple if you haven't done so already. And I'll read it out next week on the show. So go and do that. Hear about your review next week. Everyone's a winner. Right, I'm going to shoot off now. Take care. Have a lovely week. See you next Friday.